Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Friday, September 18th, 2020. Producing from his home studio in the foothills of Connecticut is Taylor Schwenk. I'm Buster, only working from my home studio in New York. I'll start out by saying it again. Thank you to the listeners for the tremendous support this year. As you talked about on the podcast yesterday, our listenership is up 30% year over year. Very exciting numbers, especially in a year that has been so strange, and it was no baseball for so long. To get that kind of support is so amazing. Some notes as we start today. The Padres and Mariners series for the weekend has been moved from Seattle to San Diego because of the air quality issues that we're seeing in Seattle. The Dodgers reliever Caleb Ferguson is going to have Tommy John surgery. His season is likely over. The other day, Dave Roberts told reporters that the MRI had come back not very good. St. Louis Cardinals right-hander Dakota Hudson had to leave his start yesterday due to elbow tightness. This, of course, at a time when the Cardinals are dealing with all these doubleheaders, it really does feel like that all the extra games they had to play in the aftermath of their shutdown have started to catch up with the team. The Indians had lost 8 straight games going into Thursday, but Shane Bieber, stopper, took the mound for them yesterday, and he was terrific. 7 2/3 innings, 3 runs allowed, 10 strikeouts, and he got help from Jose Ramirez.
Here's the 3-2, swung on, and there's a high fly ball. Deep right field, way back. Home run, Jose Ramirez. Another 2-homer game for Ramirez as he takes Mize deep for the second time tonight.
That from WTM 1100, the Indians win that game 10-3. Bryce Harper had a big night against the Mets, and it was punctuated by this home run.
In the air to right field. Wow! Forget about that one. That is a long home run off the facing of the upper deck. Woo! 445 feet. His second home run of the game. The Phillies lead it 5-3.
Now, at the end of the day, the Phillies would still be in as the 8th seed in the National League, but Joe Girardi, their manager, told reporters yesterday that JT Realmuto will not be available through the weekend in all likelihood. So that's a concern for the Phillies as they move through this completely wide-open wild-card race in the National League. The Yankees have been on a roll, and man, their 4th inning yesterday was a whopper.
That one is driven deep to right center field. There it goes. See ya. Into the Yankee bullpen. A 2-run shot for Gardner. And the Yankees now lead 5-2. LeMahieu fights one off. Fly ball deep right. Going back, Hernandez. That's gone. Oh, my. How did that get out? A home run for LeMahieu. And it's 6-2 Yankees as they go back to back. Luke Voit wraps one deep into right center field. There it goes. See ya. Back to back to back. 20th home run for Voit, and the Yankees are pouring it on as they lead 7-2. High fly ball, right field. There it goes. They've done it again. They set a big league record. 17 home runs in 3 games, and the Yankees lead 8-2. High fly ball, deep left center. There it goes. How about 5? See ya. A home run for Gleyber Torres. The Bronx Bombers are flexing. 9-2 Yankees.
So 5 home runs for the Yankees in that 4th inning. They had 19 home runs in the 3-game series. That's the most in a single series of any length in Major League Baseball history. And they crushed the record, which had been held by the 1963 Twins, who had 17 homers in a 4-game series against the Washington Senators. The Yankees' 19 home runs, the most for any 3-game span in Major League Baseball history. The Tampa Bay Rays, moving closer to clinching a playoff spot, faced the Baltimore Orioles, looking to sweep a doubleheader, and it happened.
Now the 1-2 pitch on its way. Swinging a ground ball right side. This should do it. Brasso has it. Throws to first. Rays win! Rays win, and for the second consecutive season, the Tampa Bay Rays are going to the postseason for the 6th time in team history. As there are high fives and handshakes, the Tampa Bay Rays are on to the postseason once again.
That from the Rays Radio Network and via MLB.com. the White Sox and the Twins. The score was tied 2-2 in the sixth inning, and then a bizarre play happened.
And then this, deep down the left field line, home run. Donaldson with a solo home run. And the Twins have hit three against Lopez this afternoon.
And what a move by manager Rocco Baldelli to come out and defuse that situation, let Donaldson focus back in on what he's trying to do. And then the spark that he needed, Donaldson didn't miss it.
He tossed him. They just tossed Donaldson for kicking dirt on home plate as he crossed home plate. So now here comes Rocco Baldelli, and he's likely to get tossed too. Donaldson kicked dirt on home plate as he crossed it, and Dan Bellino's just kicked him out of the game.
You see something you may maybe never have seen before. I have never seen a guy get thrown out after hitting a home run. But Donaldson obviously fired up. You don't like to see him getting ejected, but sometimes the emotion just gets the best of you.
Yep, that's what happened. Josh Donaldson didn't like a previous strike call made by home plate umpire Dan Bellino, and as he crossed home plate, he kicked dirt on home plate. Bellino ejected him. At that point, the Twins held a 3-2 lead, but the White Sox would come back.
And he rips one down the left field side. That's a fair ball into the corner. Sanchez turns third. He's on his way to the plate. Abreu gets the stop sign at third. Another run is home, and the White Sox have untied it. It's now 4-3 here in the seventh.
The White Sox with the lead, that from WGN, and that moved the White Sox to within just a handful of outs to clinching a playoff appearance.
He swings and hits a high fly ball into left center field. Luis Robert, he's there. He's got it. It's playoff time for the Chicago White Sox. They have qualified for the playoffs for the first time since 2008. And they get a 4-3 win here against the Minnesota Twins and take 3 out of 4 from Minnesota.
We're going to be talking about the White Sox as the number one seed in the American League with Jesse Rogers. And we're going to be talking about that Josh Donaldson ejection, as well as a conversation with Todd Radom, the chief executive of our weekly quiz. Before we get to all that, check out the latest episode of The Low Post. Zach Lowe discusses the end of the Clipper season and previews the Western Conference Finals with TNT's Stan Van Gundy, who, by the way, is a huge baseball fan, Taylor. I don't know if you knew that. I was down in spring training one year, and Stan saw me, came over, and it was like our conversation was him asking me baseball questions, me asking him NBA questions, getting the behind-the-scenes talk.
I think that sounds like an amazing podcast. I love Stan Van Gundy. That could be good, Buster.
You know what? We ought to have him on.
Let's
just get some observations from that. That actually would be fun. You can listen to The Low Post wherever you get your podcasts.
You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish.
Yes. The clutch hits, the strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems, with nothing on your roof. So whoever's up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, you name it, they won't find a satellite dish. But you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, 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 with nothing on your roof. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit DirectTV.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code BASEBALL. That's code BASEBALL. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
Jesse Rogers covers baseball for ESPN. And Jesse, I knew you were chomping at the bit on some particular thought because you sent me an email yesterday saying you had a thought about playoff strategy.
Yes, I did, Buster. So hear me out on this one. It involves starting pitching and who your top three starters are going to be. Let me use the White Sox as my example, a team that just got into the postseason. They have two solid starters in Lucas Giolito and Dallas Keuchel. Of course, the guy with the most experience on that team in terms of October. Now, after that, they have young guys, Dane Dunning and Dylan Cease, good young starters. So this is my idea. In the best of three, if you win game one with Lucas Giolito, would you consider starting the less experienced pitcher in game two and saving Keuchel for a win or go home situation in game three? If you win game two, all of a sudden you have Dallas Keuchel opening the next round. You lose game two, you have the guy that has pitched in the World Series pitching an elimination game. Any team with a young, inexperienced third starter, I think, should consider that. What do you think?
You know, that's interesting. And as you said that, I thought, you know who we ought to have on the podcast next week is Tim Corbin, who's the head coach at Vanderbilt, because, of course, in the championship round at the College World Series, that's the sort of quandary that they deal with all the time. Like, how do you line up your best pitchers? And, you know, it'd be interesting to get some insight with you. But I like that idea, you know, where you roll the dice and hope that you can get it. You know, I just pulling a team out of the mix, for example, you know, the Yankees will start Garrett Cole. Let's say they win game one with Garrett Cole, then game two, go bullpen game and try to wrap it up there. And then maybe you've got Tanaka in the bag. And if you win game two with a bullpen game, then potentially you could start Tanaka in game one and you're better set up for that series. But there's a lot of stuff I think that's going to happen with the starting pitching because of the fact, you know, in that first, the first round is going to be three straight days, but then later in the World Series, you're going to have seven straight days. I really like that part of this postseason.
Yeah, that's really going to be different for executives and managers when they set up. They've been so used to the off days. This is going to be really different. This is why around the deadline, I think I was on with you, I was harping on starting pitching. The Cubs had enough, and I kept asking Jed Hoyer, did you go out and look for more? That's why the Clevinger trade was so huge. My point being, you absolutely need four more than ever. In their past, you could get away with three. You have an extra round, and you have less off days. You need four starters. So back to my idea. Look, we always talk about the ninth inning is different, right? That's why you have to have a special guy on the mound as a closer. Elimination games are different, too. You need a special guy on the mound to take the ball in those. And I just, if you're up 1-0, you have some ways to work this thing. Now, if you're down 1-0, you have to start Dallas Keuchel in game two. You have to start Tanaka in game two, obviously. But it's that up 1-0 scenario I think teams should consider, Buster.
Yep. And I think they will. It'll be interesting to see how the different managers handle that, how the analytics department and front offices handle that. You mentioned that you feel like teams need to have four starting pitchers. They're going to need five. Like, this is the first postseason, because they're not going to be a lot of teams, especially with these analytically driven front offices, who are going to be like, yeah, you know what, let's start our number one on 3 days rest. There might be some guys like a Garrett Cole, you could see that. You know, Trevor Bauer would be all in on that, like right away with the Reds. He'd be like, I can throw all day. But then there'd be other teams that wouldn't have that, which is, it's interesting that some of the teams that have the deeper rotations, the Minnesota Twins come to mind, actually, the deeper they go, they may have more of an advantage because they have more options.
No doubt about it. You're so right. I mean, that second round, best of five straight days, are you going to start your number one starter on short rest or go with your number five? What a tough decision to make. I'll take the Cubs, the team I cover. Alec Mills is their fifth starter. He just threw a no-hitter. Okay, now I don't know what he's going to look like 2 weeks from now, but is he the guy in a game five elimination? Or is it Yu Darvish, one of the all-world pitchers, you know, going right now on 3 days rest? It is just, these decisions are going to be crazy when it comes to the elimination games.
All right, yesterday, the biggest moment, I think, in baseball was when Josh Donaldson hit a home run for the Twins to give them a lead in the game over the White Sox after he had disputed a couple calls made by home plate umpire Dan Bellino. And as Josh Donaldson crosses home plate, he kicks dirt on it. Bellino ejects him. Donaldson, very angry about the previous strike calls. And I got to tell you, I love Josh Donaldson. I mean, this is someone who has so much passion for what he does. He really is one of the pioneers of the launch angle generation. But watching that play out yesterday, I was like, dude, you can't let yourself get thrown out of that game in that spot. And I love Justin Morneau doing the serving as the analyst on the Twins broadcast, basically saying, I've never seen that before. Guy hits a home run and he gets ejected. And on top of that, it's a big game for the Twins as they angle for playoff seeding.
Yeah, I was watching it live as well. I was having my second cup of coffee in the afternoon. I literally spit it up. I could not believe he did that. And then he came back. You know, he went a couple steps towards the dugout, came back and did it again. So that was something. And look, they got down after that. That was, I think, the go-ahead run. They were yep. They got down. His spot in the order came up in the eighth or ninth inning, and that could have been a difference maker. They lost by a run. That was a huge little turn there when he did that. So. A terribly selfish move from a guy that isn't known for doing that, but obviously he was frustrated. It was a terrible strike call. There's no doubt about it. But look, you hit a home run, should be water under the bridge at that point. Big mistake. Like I said, one run loss, and he came up in that later in the game, or his spot did. So I haven't seen many of those at all. You're right. I mean, it happens once in a blue moon. But I loved it. I got to say, I loved it. It was an entertaining moment. To see a player kick dirt on the home plate after hitting a home run. Here's my question: He doesn't get one more day out of that, right? For showing up the umpire that badly.
No, I don't think so. I think that'll just.
I don't
be
either.
I think if there's any ramifications, it might be in a nice way from inside of his clubhouse. Like I would love to have been a fly on the wall yesterday, in the late innings, and then after the game, someone as respectful as Rocco Baldelli, a great teammate like Nelson Cruz. Saying to Josh, dude, we need you. Like, we need you on the field. And you're right. The call made by Dan Bellino that he was most upset about was definitely outside the strike zone. The other part of that surprised me a little bit is, like, I've gotten to know Dan Bellino, the umpire who was involved in that. He's, like, a nice guy. He's not a confrontational guy. He's not one of the umpires who are in players' faces all the time. And so Josh really did kind of pick a fight with him.
Yeah, if that's true, and I don't know Dan, then that's Josh must know that as well, right? If you know that he's a nice that's really sticking it to a nice guy. You know what I mean? That's really showing up a guy that it sounds like most people kind of like and whatnot. So very surprising to see that. It may have cost his team a game. Now we have no idea. He could strike out that last at bat, but it could have cost his team a game because the guy's got home run power.
Okay, the White Sox, with that win yesterday, they qualify for the playoffs. And here's a comparison that I want to make that you are better qualified than anybody to assess. I feel like the 2020 White Sox, who at this point might be the number one seed in the American League, are a lot like the 2015 Cubs, a team you covered, where they have arrived on the scene maybe a year sooner than what people thought.
Yeah, that's a good observation. I think a lot of people in Chicago feel the same way. I think there's some comparisons even to they signed Dallas Keuchel, just like the Cubs signed John Lester, as sort of that final piece in the rotation to elevate your team. They're a little too young maybe to go all the way, but you never know. The Cubs got to the NLCS that first year because sometimes, you're dumb and naive about these things, right? What's really impressed me about the White Sox, Buster, is how they've matured within the 60 games. They had a couple rough spots early. When the Cardinals came out of their COVID situation, they swept the White Sox in a doubleheader, and it seemed like the White Sox weren't ready. And all of a sudden, when there were games like that, possible letdown games, they started to overcome. They weren't very good against right-handed pitching. They were below 500 against plus 500 teams, and they reversed those trends. They've come up big and learned how to hit right-handed pitching a little bit better. And it's not all about the home runs for them, which it was earlier. So there are some comparisons, and it mostly comes in just kind of maturing. And I can remember a series, 2015, the Cubs against the Giants in August that really elevated them. Remember the Giants? That was the Giants in the middle of their great run. The White Sox have had a series or two like that. They just got through a huge one against the Twins, just grinding out these wins for a series win. They also had a couple against the Indians that they've played well in. So I do see similarities, but in this postseason, anything is possible. And I mean, if their offense shows up, and we know it doesn't always in October, sky's the limit for them. But I'm sure in four series coming up in the playoffs, at some point they're going to have to rely on pitching. And there is a lot of inexperience outside of Dallas Keuchel in October.
And, of course, game one, if the standings hold as they are right now, game one, they'd be facing Shane Bieber, who's going to win the Cy Young in the American League. And who knows what's going to happen at that point. The White Sox could have this tremendous season of progress and run right into the pitcher you do not want to face in the American League playoffs. This Sunday, we've got Yu Darvish pitching against the Minnesota Twins. You know, as part of my preparation, I went back and read your story on Darvish and how he's made progress. I've talked to some other people. And what I've really sort of gathered was that it was almost like coming off the 2017 World Series, where he was a starting pitcher in Game 7. You know, he mentioned to staffers and the Dodgers before that game, hey, you know, are you sure you want to start me? In so many words, he said that just before the start of the game. You know, they had Clayton Kershaw. They could have theoretically gone to that day. They wind up losing that game. And what I've gotten back from a lot of people is they really feel like that in some respects, he was kind of knocked back on his heels from the 2017 World Series experience, even after getting that big contract from the Cubs. And it took him a little while to get comfortable and for lack of a better way to describe it, recover from that experience. What's your take?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I think there's two other things involved. One, in terms of his confidence, when the Astros got caught cheating, that kind of helped him. Like, a lot of people were on his side from that moment on, right? It was everybody against the Astros, and Darvish kind of got let off the hook. Hey, maybe there was more at play than me tipping my pitches. They were stealing the sign. So that was one thing that changed. And also, he got completely healthy, finally, in his mind. And when you are healthy and have that kind of ability, man, you can let it fly. I think the most surprising thing or interesting thing for me covering Darvish these last few years is, you know, sort of the second portion of his career, Buster, is how sort of, insecure he was, even in Texas, when he came over from Japan, when he got his feet under him and started pitching well in Texas, he has said often up here with the Cubs that this is the best he's ever felt or pitched. Like, and he has said that early on in his Cubs career here, you know, once he got past the injuries, like Texas wasn't just, he wasn't completely himself down there. He certainly wasn't himself in LA. Now he can finally be himself. And I documented in the piece, you know, he could pitch backwards now, which in 2012, he wasn't really the norm. He can work slow and he wasn't really allowed to do that back then. So there's just a lot of things baked into this thing with him elevating his game. Having said that, by the way, he's had two starts that have trended a little bit different. Now, maybe he couldn't keep up the pace that he was on. Last start, he came out and said he was terrible. He was god-awful. He had nothing. Having said that, he lasted 7 innings. And that's the other big difference with him, Buster. His floor for any outing is now much higher than it used to be. He's a 6 or 7 inning guy, even on his worst days. And that is not something we saw early in his Cubs career.
So the last time we had the Cubs on Sunday Night Baseball, Alex Rodriguez and I had a conversation about Javier Baez. And I just mentioned to him, I said, look, you know, there's no question that no fans in the stands is a completely different experience, not only for, you know, for baseball, but for the players. And not having the juice of having the instant feedback from fans when you make a great play. And one of the guys that I wonder, and we talked about this, that I felt like was potentially most affected was Javier Baez. Like, he absolutely is someone who's built for a stage. Alex agreed with me. It is interesting. In the last week, it feels like he's starting to turn the corner a little bit. What are you seeing in him?
Yeah, let me say this. I don't 100% agree with that. Now, obviously, guys like that feed off the crowd for sure. There's some elements to that. But I think the thing that he complained about the other day is more important. The lack of ability to watch the at-bats in game, to go back to the video replay room and watch. And think about this with him in particular. Here's a guy that is swinging and missing at those outside sliders often. Don't you think it probably could help a guy, especially that does that, to go back and, hey, oh my God, I missed that by a foot. I missed that by 2 inches. I gotta get back within myself here. Like, I think the lack of in-game video replay affects some guys more than others. And I think he's near the top of the list. The crowd certainly must affect some guys more than others. And maybe he's at the top of the list there as well. But I will say early in this thing, he actually not applauded it, but he was like, well, we can communicate better on defense without the crowd. It's not so bad. So I understand the idea of high energy guys missing the energy of a crowd. That just isn't, that makes sense. But I do think there's some other things in play. Having said that, look, if on Sunday you see him going to right field, whether it's inside outing a pitch or just taking that outside pitch and driving it to right, that's the sign. That is the sign. I don't care if it's a ground ball through the hole, through the shift, or the inside outing doubles down the line. That's what he needs to do. Obviously, taking that outside pitch to right or laying off of it is what makes him, you know, that's the sign he's coming out of it. He's doing that a little bit more, but it has been starts and stops with him, Buster.
John Lester, after his start the other day, spoke pretty openly with you guys about feeling some emotion, knowing that it might wind up being his last start at Wrigley Field, and, you know, never envisioning, of course, that it would happen without fans in the stands. The Cubs signed him as they were beginning to turn the corner in the winter of 2014-2015 to a six-year, $155 million deal. That's one of those the small handful of deals that absolutely paid off for the team in a big way, where you can go back and say that that certainly was worth what the investment was initially. I think we could say that about Max Scherzer and the Nationals, that that's the case. How important do you think that is to John, that, you know, he lived up his end of that bargain?
Immensely, immensely important. He really has found a home here in Chicago, and man, that guy's got a lot of pride, right? What he has done just this season to turn things around a little bit, because he had a stretch of four or five games where he was kind of bad. I mean, he really went to work and found some mechanical changes that needed to happen, and he fixed it between starts from September 6th to September 11th. He fixed what was bothering him. Best free agent signing the city has seen on either side of town, Chicago, Cubs or White Sox. One of the best in any sport in this town, at least. To live up to 6 years, to be the leader, to help you win a World Series, ending that drought, to leave money on the table. The Giants were offering more money. I mean, he wants to come back and win number 200 in a Cubs uniform. We don't hear about win totals very often, do we, Buster? This is a guy that wants to win 200. He's at 192. He wants to do in a Cubs uniform. And I think he hopes to get like a CC Sabathia kind of, you know, the end of his Yankees career. Let's give him a one-year deal. I think he hopes that happens. But I'm not sure the finances of baseball are going to allow it to happen. He's a $10 million buyout, so the salary has to start at $10 million if he returns. So all of that is in play, but he has lived up to everything, if not more. And I can't stress you enough how much he's found a home here. Nothing against the Boston Red Sox. They drafted him. He has an affinity there. But this is, you know, like, I feel like if he goes to the Hall of Fame, he might wear a Cubs – he might want to wear a Cubs hat or whatever the case may be. This is really home for him right now.
And last one before you go, we got about a minute left. I've been talking this week about how it feels like the playoff seedings, generally speaking, the American League really don't matter, because, you know, whether you're the one seed or the eight seed, you got the best out of three, you got the best out of five. There's no real home field advantage because there's not fans in the stands. I'd say this. I feel like the seeding that currently stands, which has the Yankees at five and the Minnesota Twins at four, that matters. That would mean those two teams would play each other, and the Yankees, time after time after time, the last 20 years have beaten the Twins. I got to believe the Twins want to play somebody else.
I guess so. I mean, you know, you'll talk to Twins players and say, well, I wasn't here for most of those, but I don't disagree with that thought. I think there'd be a lot of runs scored in that game, in that series. I mean, a lot of home runs in that series. But you're right. That might be the one matchup I could think of that you know, they want to avoid just because the history of it all. But I am so looking forward to next month. I don't think we know what's going to happen. I agree with everyone. The Dodgers look like world beaters, but Buster, best of three, best of five.
I
mean, those first two rounds are going to be wild with no off days. Who knows what's going to happen? Injuries within series, all sorts of crazy things. But certainly the Dodgers look like the cream of the crop in both leagues. But there are contenders, and certainly there will be some upsets.
All right, Jesse, great to talk to you. Thanks for doing this.
Talk to you soon. Enjoy Sunday night. See ya.
For the ones who get it done, Grainger offers high-quality supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as access to product specialists who have the knowledge and experience to answer your toughest questions. Plus, their commitment to being your safety partner can help you keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call. Click Grainger.com or just stop by.
Dogs are an important part of our lives. That means protecting them from parasites. Ask your vet about NexGard Plus, a fox alarmer. moxidectin, and pyrantel chewable tablets. NexGard Plus Chews provides one-and-done monthly protection against fleas, ticks, heartworm disease, roundworms, and hookworms. Plus, they're delicious and easy to give. Use with caution in dogs with a history of seizures or neurological disorders. Dogs should be tested for existing heartworm infection prior to starting a preventive. Ask about NexGard Plus Chews.
Todd Radom is the chief executive of our weekly quiz. He's a graphic artist whose work can be seen on ball fields all across the world, all around America, or you can go to his website, toddradom.com. And, of course, he's the author of the book Winning Ugly, which now, Todd, is coming out of paperback.
Yes, Buster. We have ugly uniforms and just kind of a general overall history of the baseball uniform coming out in paperback September 29th, wherever books are sold.
Yeah, and I saw the couple people they were tweeting at you the other day. You had signed copies, and I know you well enough to know that that's something you would facilitate easily for anyone who asked. All right, before we get to this week's quiz, our ballpark study this week is around the ballpark in Kansas City, Kauffman Stadium. And I got to tell you, I have a very specific memory of this ballpark. You know, as my awareness of baseball was formulating in 1973, I remember listening to the All-Star game that year on radio, and it was coming from Kansas City. And boy, they made such a big deal about what a beautiful ballpark that was. And everyone just raved about the waterfalls and how wonderful the place looked at night. Tell me about that ballpark.
Yeah, I mean, Buster, you hit it right out of the chute here. It is a really different kind of ballpark. It's got that very sleek, modernist design aesthetic. And I think one of the things that's really noteworthy, 1973, this is an era of concrete cookie cutters. The Vet in Philadelphia had recently opened. Cincinnati, Pittsburgh, we lumped them all together. But the K was built specifically for baseball. And that's one of the things that makes it special. It is a suburban ballpark in a certain sense. It's outside of the city, where the Oakland Coliseum, for instance, was eventually closed in. Same with Angel Stadium in Anaheim. Kauffman Stadium, you still can look out there and, you see the highway and you see that, I think it's a veterans hospital across the highway, but it has a strange defined sense of place. It's not a city ballpark, but it embraces that. It's an outlier. So in a lot of ways, it's more like Dodger Stadium than any of its contemporaries, right? And it was built well, and it's outlasted all of them. So a couple of things here. The ballpark went through a very extensive renovation about a dozen years ago. And, I think they did a pretty good job. It diminished the look of the place to some extent, particularly the exterior, which is now really clad in glass. It's a little bit of a different thing. But, the signature fountains are still there. And those giant swooping sharp lines that form the upper deck, those are those signature elements for Kauffman Stadium. The angular light towers, right, in left and right fields. It really is a different looking kind of place. And, of course, you can't think about the K without these things, the water and fountain display. Kansas City is all about fountains. That giant logo scoreboard, which was upgraded to HD a dozen years ago. I mean, talk to me here, Buster. A logo that's 12 stories high? Come on. I mean, this is something. and I love the fact that they maintain the Buck O'Neill legacy seat. They have a special person sit in Buck's seat to honor him and his legacy. And they have a really good Hall of Fame there. So Kauffman Stadium, to sum it up, scores high. Give me the fountains. Give me the gigantic logo. Give me the Buck seat. Give me those modernist lines. It really feels like a different place. And the last thing I would say, Buster, is along the lines of what we talked about with regard to Angel Stadium, it faces somewhat of a murky future. The lease expires in 2031. There has recently been a change in ownership with the club, which has not happened too often across their history. And there are rumblings of a move downtown.
Wow. That would be interesting. Boy, I haven't made any calls on that. I'm going to have to. After you say that, I'm curious about what the future would be. But that, I just love that place so much. You mentioned the Buck O'Neill seats. When I was covering the Orioles and then I covered the Yankees, when those teams would go in there, Buck would be there every day. He'd be talking to people, behind home plate, sometimes through the screen from their first row of seats. And Buck O'Neill to me was like Vin Scully. Like, he was such a big personality that I was afraid of him. And I never, I think I said hi to him a couple times, but I was like embarrassed to like take up his time. Cause I just, everyone wanted to talk with him. And I felt like, I don't know how you felt as a Red Sox fan, but I was so happy when they went to grass in that ballpark, because for years that was one of those AstroTurf surfaces, and those old Royals teams actually had an advantage because they were really fast. They were very good defensively. You know, guys like Willie Wilson, Amos Otis in the outfield, Frank White. But it seemed like such a miserable place to play for players because it was so hot. And when they put grass on there, it just made it feel a lot homier.
Yeah, I don't think you're wrong. I think, you know, to me, watching games from afar on TV, it sort of was part of that sense of place to me, that carpet. And boy, those Royal teams of the 70s, late 70s, early 80s, world champions in 85.
George Brett.
Yeah, I mean, how can you say without George Brett? Absolutely. I mean, it was just part of the whole thing. I know we're pressed for time, but you got time for a really quick Buck O'Neill story?
Let's hear it.
All right. I knew Buck O'Neill, via our friend Bob Kendrick. I did work with the New Orleans Baseball Museum back in the 90s, and I would see Bob Kendrick and Mr. Buck and Mr. Motley out there, all-star games, all this kind of stuff. So in 2001, in the aftermath of 9/11, I had my stepfather passed away in New York. It had nothing to do with 9/11, but he happened to be there for surgery at the time. And I had to take my mother back out to their home in New Mexico and waited to get out of the New York area. Flights, of course, didn't happen for several days, but I got her back out to New Mexico and I took his car back to New York. So I drove by myself from New Mexico back to New York, took 4 days. And this is, September 18th, 2001. Seeing Army trucks on Route 35, just a weird world, right? And in breaking the trip up a little bit, I made a pit stop in Kansas City, and I spent an afternoon with Bob Kendrick and Buck O'Neill at the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. And they had apparently run a contest. And Buster, if you're familiar and if our listeners are familiar with what that museum is like, there are these life-size statues of Negro League greats forming a field. So this little kid, 5-6 years old, comes in with his parents. They had won this contest. And I see Buck O'Neill out of the corner of my eye. I'm talking with Bob, running the bases, kind of pretend running the bases with this little 5-year-old kid. And I have to say, Buster, it revived my faith in humanity in the week after 9/11. Mm-hmm. And it just stays with me. I think about him all the time.
Oh, boy. Yeah, that's a great story. And it's so much of, Buck O'Neill. And anyone who saw Ken Burns's documentary on baseball, Buck O'Neill played such a big role that, and if you watch him in that was him. And he had just such a big heart, wonderful person. Thanks for telling that story. All right, let's get to this week's quiz.
Here we go. Royal Stadium, now Kauffman Stadium. Buster, you called it. They hosted the All-Star Game in the stadium's first season, 1973. But here's this week's question. This ballpark hosted the All-Star Game just 2 weeks after it first opened. Was it A, Safeco Field in Seattle, B, Riverfront Stadium in Cincinnati, C, Toronto's Sky Dome, or D, Marlins Park in Miami? 2 weeks after the stadium opened, they hosted the All-Star Game. Safeco Field in Seattle, Riverfront in Cincy, Toronto's Sky Dome, or Marlins Park? What is it?
Wow. All right. Okay. Go ahead, Taylor.
I have no idea. I'm gonna go Skydome C.
Yeah, that's what I'm gonna go to.
You're both wrong because it was Riverfront Stadium in Cincinnati in 1970. Can you imagine opening a ballpark and then 2 weeks later hosting the All-Star Game?
Man,
never gonna see that again.
No, I knew it wasn't Safeco. I, you know, thought about Riverfront because I knew I played the All-Star game there. That, of course, was where Ray Fosse got run over by Pete Rose. Yes. Am I right?
Yep.
And that would have been it. And I completely blew it. Another opportunity. Typical for 2020.
Love what these draws. Year.
Thanks, Todd. Thanks, Taylor. Please leave me alone.
Thanks, guys.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for Friday coming at ya. First one up, we got Josh Neufeld at Josh Neufeld. He writes in, just curious, this season we've seen some players who wear face coverings on the field and even while batting, but do you know of any pitchers who have worn a face covering while on the mound? I've not seen any. What about you, Buster?
No, and I've been in ballparks and watched guys throw bullpens. I don't see it there either. Mm. And look, this is apples and oranges, but I went out yesterday to a fairly crowded park, and so I was wearing a mask while I was running, and that was hard. Like,
oh,
it was hard because, you sweat, and then your mask gets a little damp, and then breathing becomes more difficult. And I was thinking about that in the context of that question, Josh, because I'm thinking if you're a pitcher and you got sweat pouring down, you're having a hard time breathing. I'm guessing that it's probably not something that we're going to see before that, because nobody is expending more energy on a baseball field at any given time than the pitcher.
Next one up, we got Jesse Pruitt at Jesse_Pruitt writes in, is Freddie Freeman at a disadvantage in the NL MVP race because of his position? He's leading the league in offensive war, but gets no value defensively, even though he's one of the best at first base.
That is a great observation, Jesse, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I wrote last winter when I was doing a top 10 ranking of first baseman, and Freddie Freeman was at number one, that in recent years, like in the last decade, last 15, 20 years, you've seen first baseman fare worse and worse in the MVP voting, in part because teams don't really, just keep one guy. A lot of teams won't keep one guy as their first baseman. They'll go with platoons. They'll go with matchups. They'll move guys around. And so you're not seeing as many first basemen as, say, 40, 50 years ago who were in the MVP. I think right now he's got a legit shot. As we talked about yesterday with Eduardo Perez, feels like that Fernando Tatis Jr., it was his award to win, but his struggles in this month have brought him back to the pack.
Absolutely. Last one for today, Don Irvine at Don Irvine writes in, after this lost season, what will the Nationals have to do in the offseason to get back in the top tier of NL teams?
They got to get another hitter. They got to get somebody to compliment Juan Soto, somebody who's going to help protect Juan Soto in the lineup. Boy, what a difference it makes to not have Anthony Rendon, which we shouldn't be surprised about because Rendon is probably the best pure hitter in baseball. But man, do they need another thumper, because Juan Soto, he's so good that moving forward, he's just not going to get pitched to. He's going to get the Barry Bonds treatment unless they wind up putting someone at least near him that'll help give him more pitches to hit.
I wonder if the Nationals have any buyer's remorse with the big Steven Strasburg contract and not giving that money to Anthony Rendon.
Yeah, my sense is after talking with people that Rendon was kind of out the door. On the other hand, Steven has made it clear that he really likes to play in Washington. So, and remember, they were both represented by the same agent, Scott Boras.
tricky situation there. All right, everyone, that does it for Bleacher Tweets. Thanks for writing in. Keep them coming over the weekend. Hashtag Bleacher Tweets on Twitter. And please subscribe to, rate, and review this podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. And tell a friend, as always. Thank you very much.
That's it for today. That's it for this week. My thanks to Jesse, to Todd, to Taylor. Have a great day, everybody. Have a great weekend. Stay safe. And remember, hate and inequality based on skin color is something that we have to fight against every single day.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.